reassure you that I'm not going to play the violin tonight, because that's only for people of a certain nervous disposition. So I didn't bring any slides with me. I must say I normally do talk with a few slides, but I thought it would be a change to just try to tell you in words what it is that we're studying in the Higgs boson. Now, amazingly, in this day and age, one can actually go into a pub and mention the Higgs boson, and people know what you're talking about. And that's astonishing to me. 30 years ago, when I first started studying particle physics, well, actually 35, I'm sorry to say, it wasn't the case that people heard of the Higgs boson, which is not because it wasn't around. The Higgs boson has been around with us since 1960. It was because the consciousness about fundamental physics was not at the level it is today, and that, I think, is not an accident. It's partially to do with people like me spending an awful lot of my time talking, and also people like my old friend Brian Cox, who has done an enormously good job in popularising physics. So the UK is a really, really remarkable position at the moment of having a very large number of people who can talk in general terms about science. And I think it's not true, for example, in Germany, where I now spend most of my research time. So I'm assuming that even though you've heard of the Higgs boson, you may need a refresher on the standard model of particle physics. Would anyone like to think they wouldn't need a refresher on the standard model, because that would save me 5 or 10 minutes? No, I see that I'd better give you a refresher. So our understanding of how the universe works is based on a very simple model, simple in principle, complicated mathematically, which says that we can understand the complexities of the universe around us in terms of a very small number of fundamental forces acting on a very small number of fundamental point-like particles. When I say point-like, I mean point as Euclid meant a point, that which has no breadth. We'll come to why that's a problem in a while. But that model, which we've established over the past 40 years or so, ever since I came into particle physics, I was probably the last generation of students for whom the particle model wasn't part of, the standard model wasn't part of their background. I had a much more complicated time as a student. But now we can use this very simple model, and what it essentially consists of are 12 particles of matter, and 12 antiparticles, which have the same properties but opposite electric charge. And these particles come in what we call families. There are 3 separate families, and everything that we see around us, all the things that make up your bodies, consist of only just the particles in the first generation. So there are 2 sorts of particles, quarks and leptons, and there are 4 different forces, the strong force, the weak force, the gravitational force, and the electromagnetic force. Now, gravity, of course, is familiar to you. It's what keeps us on the Earth as the Earth moves with enormous velocity through space. And to us, it seems very strong. I mean, getting off the ground is, you know, quite an effort, especially when you're as hot as me. And that sort of strength of gravity is an illusion in many ways, because when you compare it with the strengths of any of the other forces, it's so infinitesimally tiny that if I'm making a calculation in particle physics, I never bother to include gravity. It's there, but its effects are so tiny at the atomic level that we just ignore it. The reason why it seems very strong to you and me is because, as far as we know, there's no such thing as anti-gravity. So every particle, no matter how small, attracts every other particle. And by the time you get to the size of you and me, billions upon billions of atoms inside us, all attracting us and being attracted by the Earth, then gravity to us feels extremely strong. But at the atomic and subatomic level, where these quarks and leptons exist, then gravity is so entirely negligible that we don't bother taking it into account. The next force which you're familiar with is electromagnetism, and that is the thing which makes magnets work, which is what lightning does when it strikes the Earth from the clouds, and what happens when you plug something into a wall socket and drive electrons from one end to the other. So 2 familiar forces. The other 2 forces are not so familiar, but they're just as important in how the universe works. The weak force and the strong force. The strong force is what makes atoms stable. If you bring together 2 charged particles of equal and opposite charge, then they will repel each other. If you ever rubbed a balloon down against your clothes and held it against your hand, it would be attracted to your hand because there are opposite charges involved there. Equal charges repel each other. The nucleus consists of protons and neutrons. Protons have a positive charge, neutrons have no electric charge. The protons push each other apart, and left to themselves, all nuclei would disintegrate, and there would be no stable atoms, there would be no you and me, and the universe would be a very boring place. So fortunately for us, the strong force counteracts this repulsion of the protons. It keeps the protons and the neutrons together in the nucleus and allows most nuclei to be stable, and that's why we exist. So the strong force is extremely important. It also makes the quarks stick inside the proton and neutron. The final force is the weak force, and the weak force is what's responsible for heavy particles decaying into light particles. The neutron is slightly heavier than the proton, and the neutron, if it's in free space, will decay into a proton with a lifetime of a few minutes. And that is mediated by the weak force. Without that, the sun wouldn't shine. And yet again, the universe would be an extremely boring place, filled with nothing but microwave background radiation from the Big Bang. So all four of these forces are required, are absolutely essential for a universe like the one we live in. And if any of them were even slightly different in strength, almost always the universe that would result from that would be very boring, filled with no matter, just radiation a couple of degrees above absolute zero. So fortunately for us, all these forces exist, and they have exactly the right strength to produce the richness of the universe that we see around us. So those are the forces. They act on these small number of particles in three generations. The first generation, the up and down quarks, and the electron and the neutrino electron, are the things which make up our bodies. The protons and neutrons consist of three quarks, two up quarks, and a down quark for the proton, two down quarks and an up quark for the neutron. So they make up the nucleus. So all of the nuclei of all the stable atoms, and indeed the unstable atoms, consist simply of quarks bound together in these protons and neutrons. Surrounding the nuclei are the electrons orbiting in shells, and the interactions of these shells of electrons are what basically drive the sciences of biology and chemistry. So we can understand, if we wish, I mean, it's extremely difficult, but you can in principle understand most interactions in chemistry by taking it back down to the quantum mechanics, as we call it, the physics of how electron shells interact. No sensible chemist would do it that way, but nevertheless you can in principle. So that's the standard model of particle physics, and that would be complete because that's everything that we see around us. But for reasons we don't understand, there are two more of these generations of particles with more quarks and leptons, identical to the other two, but heavier. And we don't understand why that is. There's no reason in our standard model why they should be there. They're not necessary for us to exist. They're only produced in the most extraordinary events in the universe, like supernova explosions, or artificially by heavy particles, very fast and energetic particles, hitting the Earth's atmosphere to produce cosmic rays, which are, I should mention, showering us all the time as we sit here in this room, mostly going through us and not interacting. Especially neutrinos, which go all the way through the Earth. So those are the particles that we know about, and there are three generations that we know about. The heaviest of these generations, the third generation, has a particle in it called the top quark, which is so massive that it has the same mass as an atom of gold. Now that might not seem surprising to you, were it not for the original premise, which is that these particles are point-like. So how can something with no size have enormous mass? And if you know the answer to that, you should write a paper, because you'll get a Nobel Prize. Knows the answer to that question. It's a deep mystery, but being physicists and pragmatists, we just accept it because the mathematics works, and we use it, and amazingly, it can explain everything that's happened in the universe since the very first tiny fractions of a second after the Big Bang all the way to the present day. By putting together all of these forces, we can actually understand that the evolution of the universe right back to almost the very first fraction of a second after the Big Bang. So that was the quick course on the standard model. So now you're fully seized of how the universe works. I can tell you where the Higgs particle comes in. The thing about the Higgs particle is that without it, none of these particles, these quarks and leptons in their three families, would have any mass. And if they didn't have any mass, neither would the proton and the neutron, and neither would you and me. So that again would be a bit of a disaster, because we wouldn't exist, and again the universe would be a very dull place. So you're starting to get the picture that almost all alternative universes don't have anything happening in them. We're in a very unique situation. So the Higgs boson is the thing which gives these particles a mass. The reason why we need it is because any other way of directly giving particles a mass produces infinities when you do the mathematical calculation. So when you divide the number of probability to produce an electron in a certain place, if you try to give it a mass explicitly, the answer you get is infinite, and that's not much use, because infinity is not a very helpful concept. So we need this Higgs boson because it's the only mathematical solution we have which allows us to actually assign a mass to a particle and then to actually make a calculation with our theories, which gives a commonsensical answer, which is finite and which we can use to calculate things. Without the Higgs boson, then none of those calculations would work, none of the theories would work, and indeed the universe, as we've said, would be filled with massless particles, which would be very sad. So that's why the Higgs boson is there. Now let me, in the remaining 10 minutes or so, tell you what the Higgs boson is and how it works. And I'll try to use an analogy in a second, but let me first tell you what it is. Firstly, the Higgs boson is a self-interaction of a field. A field is just a way in which we assume that particles can interact with each other. The Higgs boson, the Higgs field, fills the whole of the universe, as far as we can tell. And what happens is that particles interact with that field. Now, in order to understand what they do, I need to take you back briefly to Einstein's special theory of relativity. You're getting all sorts of theories in this little talk. Einstein's theory of relativity, which of course is the basis for all of modern science, tells us that nothing can travel faster than light. The speed of light is extremely fast, and nothing can travel faster than light. And despite what you might have read in the newspapers about neutrinos travelling faster than light about a year ago, that turned out to be an error in the experiment. Excuse me, let me just take a quick drink. So, light consists of photons, another invention of Einstein. And photons have zero mass. They're massless particles. They don't interact with this Higgs field because they have no mass. And Einstein's theory also tells us that not only is the speed of light the maximum velocity that you can have, but also that any particle that has no mass will travel at the speed of light. In fact, the only free particles that we know about that have no mass are photons, so this doesn't come into the discussion very often. There are other particles in the Standard Model which have no mass. The gluons, which hold the quarks in the proton, have no mass, but they're confined inside the proton, so it's not relevant. So any particle that has no mass would travel at the speed of light. So there we have the Higgs field, and we have all of these quarks and leptons coming along, and they interact with the Higgs field. And what they do when they interact with the Higgs field is they're slowed down by it. They all want to travel at the speed of light because they're massless originally. But then the Higgs field slows them down, and it slows them down by different amounts. And as soon as they slow down, it's equivalent to them having a mass, because particles with a mass will travel slower than the speed of light. So the Higgs field is like, it's like dropping ball bearings through glycerine or treacle. When you drop it through air, it goes down very fast. When you drop it through this resistive medium, it goes slower. And the Higgs field is a bit like treacle filling the universe. And the particles, that the quarks and leptons, travel through this Higgs field, and they are pushed by the Higgs field and slow down and therefore acquire a mass. So that's the Higgs field. The Higgs boson is a bit like a whirlpool in that goo that we talked about, the Higgs field, or the glycerin, or the viscous material. It's a bit like a whirlpool. It's a self-excitation. It's something which is produced automatically by fluctuations that give rise to vacuums. Just like if you watch water travelling over a very rocky field path in a riverbed, then you'll get these occasional vortices. They're random. They don't occur at a given time very often. They just occur randomly. And the Higgs particle is a vortex in this Higgs field. We have no idea what its mass was. We didn't have any idea until we discovered it, we hope, at the LHC. But we knew that it, for self-consistent reasons, couldn't be so massive that we couldn't see it at the LHC. So we believed that we would see it at the Large Hadron Collider. Unfortunately, we seem to have done so. So that's the Higgs field. Let me try and give you an analogy to make it a little bit clearer how it works. Imagine that you're a young person who's very keen to get a partner. And you've got to a computer dating agency, and you've been invited to an evening where you're told that all sorts of attractive people will attend, and you'll find all sorts in common with them, and you'll be able to meet and talk to them. So you all arrive at this venue, and there's a bar, of course, as there would be any such thing. They're serving drinks, and so you all mill around and talk aimlessly, but you're all extremely keen to find a very attractive partner. And then suddenly what happens is that Marilyn Monroe walks into the room, and by her side is, what's a particularly attractive man? Who?
Johnny Depp,
yes, right, Johnny Depp. So they both walk in. Now, they're, of course, especially Johnny Depp, is very keen to get to the bar. And so they want to get to the bar. But you, all of the people who are wanting an attractive partner, of course, are immediately attracted to these very attractive people as they come in. And so you sort of go up to them and try to shake their hand and say hello and what have you, and of course you form a knot around them, a knot which impedes their progress to the bar very, very substantially. And so Pearl, Johnny and Marilyn Monroe have acquired an enormous mass. They can't make any progress. You've slowed down their progress to the bar very enormously, and so they've acquired a mass. So you're the Higgs field, and they're the quarks and the leptons. So what is the Higgs particle in this analogy? So let's suppose that Marilyn and Johnny are otherwise detained in some other Hollywood party, and you're only left to your own devices. Well, before long, you'll have all looked around the room and decided who the most attractive people are, and because you're not at all interested in things like their intelligence or whatever, you're just looking at their physical attractiveness, you will automatically gather around those people who you seem to be most attractive, and their progress to the bar will similarly be slowed down, and that knot of people gathered around a random person who is the most attractive person in the room is the Higgs boson. So that's a sexual analogy, if you like, to how the Higgs boson works. So what we think of about the Higgs boson is it's this particle which is excited inside the Higgs field, which itself is permeating the universe and slowing down all the quarks and leptons which interact with it, and giving them a mass, which then allows us to calculate with our standard model what their properties are, how they interact, and allows us to predict all of the interactions of these particles and how they govern the evolution of the universe with incredible precision. It sounds almost inconceivable that such a peculiar theory, where if you don't put the Higgs boson in, you get infinite answers, can work, but it does work. It's quite astonishing that it works. And all the experiments we've done in the past 50 years have not succeeded in finding anything which can't be explained by this very strange idea. Of course, we didn't know what its mass was. It's been around since the 1960s, this idea, but we didn't know where it was. Last July, on July the 4th, in fact, there was an announcement at CERN that we'd seen a particle which had many of the properties that we expect the Higgs boson to have. It decays into all the particles that it could do, all the quarks and leptons. It also decays into pairs of photons, which is interesting because the photon has no mass. So that's an interesting little thing, which I can tell you about if you ask me. It appears, as far as we can tell, with the very small number of events we've been able to see so far, to have all the properties of the Higgs boson to within the uncertainties which we can measure them, and it's still very early days. So it looks like it may well be the Higgs boson, and probably in the next 6 months or so we'll be sure that it is. My money is very strongly on the fact that it is. But the title of this talk is it the Higgs boson a solution or is it a problem? And it's, of course, a solution in the sense that it allows us to use this marvellous theory of the standard model in a way which now is self-consistent and where we know all the component parts. Once we know the mass of the Higgs boson, we can do some calculations even more accurately and get even more accurate results. But it's a problem because if it's all we find at the Large Hadron Collider, then we've not really made any progress beyond the standard model being established. And the reason for that is that there are open questions with the standard model, and I hinted at one of them when I talked about the fact that it uses point-like particles, which give rise to all these strange infinities. We don't understand how point-like particles can have a mass. We don't understand why there are these three generations of quarks and leptons that I told you about. Furthermore, we don't have a theory where the theory of gravity, which Einstein produced in the 1920s, actually fits with the other theories of the forces I told you about. So the standard model only models three of the four forces. It only models the strong force, the weak force, and the electromagnetic force. Gravity is outside that framework. It's outside that framework for a very deep reason to do with the fundamental randomness, which is at the root of our understanding of how the atom works. And we don't know how to unify gravity with the other three forces. And if all there is in the LHC's discoveries is a Higgs particle with the expected properties, we will not have any clue as to how to solve that remaining mystery and all the other remaining mysteries that there are. So particle physics is in this strange position where we have a theory which has stood the test of 40 years of time, which produces results which, as far as we can check them with the most accurate experiments, are accurate to many, many places of decimals. The standard model of particle physics is the most accurately tested theory in science. But nevertheless, he's clearly wrong, because it doesn't explain everything. It has lots of unanswered questions. It has fundamental logical inconsistencies, like point-like particles with enormous mass. So we need to see something beyond the Higgs if we're to understand more about how nature works. And that's why just discovering the Higgs boson is a problem. But that's looking at the glass as half empty. Let's look at it as half full. It's also a solution. It's a tremendous intellectual achievement, and it means that probably the greatest triumph of 20th century science, the discovery of how the universe came from the very first fractions of a second after the Big Bang, has come to a conclusion. It's come to an overall self-consistency, which makes it a really remarkable achievement. So let's think about the positive sides of the Higgs boson. Let's look at it as very much a solution, and maybe we should discuss what the remaining problems are. So if that's 20 minutes and one, 20 minutes and five, so I'll just sit down, shall I?